Bowman Gray School of Medicine Oral History Interview Number 2 with Dr. J. Maxwell Little, Research Professor of Pharmacology, interviewed by Dr. Harold D. Green, Research Professor of Physiology, taped on September 27, 1974 at 9 a.m. in the television studio of the Department of Audiovisual Resources.
I'm Dr. Harold D. Green, former chairman of physiology, alias Hal. And the next voice you will hear is that of Dr. J. Maxwell Little, former chairman of pharmacology, known affectionately by his friends as Max. Max, how long ago was it you first came to this institution?
Hal, before we get started, would you mind turning that sign around?
What sign are you talking about? Oh, you mean this one that says... thank you for not smoking? Okay, Max, it's
that's
got us one. Back to you.
I hope you haven't got one saying don't eat eggs in your pocket. I came here in 1941 when the school moved here from Wake Forest College.
Could you tell us something about your background before you came?
Briefly, I attended undergraduate school at Emory University, graduating during the Depression years there, and also obtained my master's degree in organic chemistry in 1933. I stayed on at Emory for a couple of years working as an assistant in the physiology department. During one of those summers, I attended the University of Michigan, helping to prepare myself a little better by taking some courses in gross anatomy. I attended Washington University for a year from 1935 to 1936, being enrolled in the graduate school in biochemistry. And then I transferred from there to Vanderbilt University and stayed there for 5 years, working towards my PhD in biochemistry and assisting in the instruction in the department. And I received my PhD in biochemistry in 1941, just prior to coming here.
Those Depression days were some days, weren't they?
They were real rough. There were a lot of PhDs pumping gas in gasoline stations during that time.
I remember going home just to visit my folks on the weekend of the banks failed. I had $10 in my pocket and a round-trip bus ticket that took me back to Cleveland. And I gave the $10 to my folks because they couldn't get any money out of the bank to operate.
Right. It was rough.
I believe that Dr. Herbert Wells was the chairman when you came. Could you tell us anything about him and how you and he happened to get together?
Dr. Wells was in the Department of Physiology at Vanderbilt, and I don't know exactly how he was recruited except that he was employed as chairman of physiology at Bowman Gray and went to Wake Forest in 1939, so he was there a year before the move. I had known Dr. Wells fairly well there since I had done some research projects in the Department of Physiology, and we had become personal friends. Now, Dr. Wells knew that he was going to need somebody to be interested in instruction and research in pharmacology, although I had had no extensive training in the field of pharmacology. It was his belief that pharmacology had its basis greatly in the field of biochemistry, and he knew that I had an interest in the biochemical effects of drugs, and I felt that I had would like to get into this type of area, and so he asked me to join him here as assistant professor of physiology and pharmacology, which I did in 1941.
What sort of person was Herbert Wells, and what were some of his interests?
Well, he was a very interesting person. He had lots of interests within the laboratory and lots of interest outside of the laboratory. He was very much interested in teaching, and he felt that it was his job to encourage the student to learn himself rather than being instructed in what he should know. And he had a philosophy of being a department chairman that I've always felt was the right one. his philosophy was that it was the chairman's job to see to it that the other members of the department had every opportunity that they could have to grow and develop, and that was the philosophy he followed. I think he had a very dry sense of humor, and I think a short story of an incident that occurred at Vanderbilt just prior to his leaving there would illustrate that. It was a custom at Vanderbilt when a person left to assume another job that this person was asked to give a seminar to the entire medical faculty, summarizing his research at that time. Well, Dr. Wells had been working on pressure changes in the gastrointestinal tract. This was one of his interests. Another interest was in the cardiovascular field. And he reported that at times he had measured negative pressure in the gastrointestinal tract. And Barney Brooks, who was one of the mainstays and professor and chairman of surgery, and of whom many people were very much afraid, got up and said that he was interested in that only Herbert Wells would ever consider the possibility that there was a negative pressure in the gut at any time. And Wells' rebuttal was, he thanked Dr. Brooks for his compliment, but he said that he couldn't take credit for that because God had thought of it before he did. But he was a very successful man, I think, in getting a department started.
Do you happen to recall where Herbert went when he left here?
When he left here, which was, I believe, in about 1944 or 43, he went to Memphis briefly in the Department of Physiology there. And then he went to St. Paul, Minnesota, where he served as a research director in a VA hospital. And he remained there until he retired a few years ago.
Do you have any particular recollections of your impressions during the first few months here at Bowman Graham?
Yes, they're still quite vivid in my memory. I remember the first day I drove up to the campus here. There was an imposing building sitting on top of a high hill, and that was the original building before the gray building was added on the front. There was a circular stairway leading up to what is now the first floor, and this came into the building about the place where Jimmy Harrell has his office at the present time. And there was also an entrance on the ground floor that went straight through a door coming in about where the elevators are now on the ground floor. The campus sloped down. There was a rather steep bank at that point, and it was a sea of mud that had been rained, and there were planks stretched over this. And if one got into the building, he had to climb up these planks across this mud bank. As I told somebody, that was my first entrance to the medical school, and I've been climbing over planks ever since that day, I think. Those first months were very interesting months, I think. There was a marked limit on the funds available to any department, and Dr. Carpenter had assigned a certain amount of money. I'm not sure now just how much money had been assigned to Dr. Wells to use for the equipping with furniture, primarily, of the Department of Physiology and Pharmacology. But Dr. Wells knew that if he spent this money on furniture, there wouldn't be anything left for scientific equipment except for student laboratory work. And so he went to Dr. Carpenter and asked his permission to build cheaper furniture instead of using this money to buy something like Kewanee furniture. And Dr. Carpenter agreed to that. So he hired a medical student to come in and work in the laboratory, bought some carpentry machinery, a bandsaw and things of that sort, and this student was very good, as was Dr. Wells in the shop. And so they built student desks, tables, and that sort of thing to equip the whole department. Some of those old student desks are still around. This left some money then for research equipment. I remember that he gave to me $1,500 to equip research labs in the area of pharmacology. Now, that doesn't sound like much money now, but at that time I was able to get reasonably good equipment for the laboratory. And I remember also that there was a grand sum of $600 for the first year or so that I could use to start a research program. And that was the money I had available at the beginning to start the research program. And of course, much of my time during that first few months was spent in trying to organize, in my own mind, a course in pharmacology. For this was to be my primary responsibility. And I had never organized, nor had I ever really taught pharmacology before. So it was quite a challenge to me to get one going at that time.
Did you and Herbert essentially constitute the department?
Yes, there was one other man, Lauren Chastain, who had come up from Wake Forest College, had been in physiology down there. There was a combined department of physiology and pharmacology there, but he was the only man who came up. Lauren had a master's degree, and he remained in the department for some time, went on to medical school eventually, and went into practice, and he died some few years back, but those were the three persons in the department at that time.
Just about like it was when I joined.
Just
you.
About the same. And Lauren and Herbert took care of physiology, and it was my responsibility to take care of pharmacology.
Well, those days of small grants were quite interesting. I remember when I was still back at Western Reserve, and I got a $300 grant from the AMA, American Medical mm-hmm. Association, and I believe I published two or three papers on that sum of money.
If you could do things yourself, you could get a lot done. I remember some difficulty in tying cannulae into dogs' arteries and veins by myself, but if you use your teeth and both hands and occasionally a foot, you could get this all done.
And we had to make a lot of our own equipment
right.
at that time. Now, some of that furniture that Herbert Wells made was really very excellent. I believe it may be still being used in some of the rooms.
It is in some of the dog boards they made. He made a mold for aluminum feet, and they constructed these dog boards, and they are being used around the school now. I still have several that I use. They've been replaced mainly by some rather fancy aluminum dog boards, but these old wooden ones serve their purpose quite well.
I believe those new ones are still the same design.
They
have the same casting for the feet as the ones that Herbert made. Do you, say prior to 1945, do you remember much about how the school operated in making decisions, what sort of, how the faculty participated in the school?
I have some recollection of this. It was largely a one-man show. Dr. Carpenter had the ultimate responsibility, as is the case now with the dean. And I feel that he made most of the decisions. However, he delegated to many of the departmental chairmen decisions in their own areas. And what they did was all right with him. If it involved expenditure of any sizable sum of money, of course he wanted them to check with him on it. There were not frequent faculty meetings, although they were interesting faculty meetings. I remember the first one I attended, we had 13 full-time faculty at the school, and we had a faculty meeting around a large table. All of us sat around a large table, and that constituted the first full-time faculty meeting. Matters were discussed at that, but no decisions made. again, Dr. Carpenter reserved the right for that. He did work through a committee system, and he would take the advice of committees. And I remember very distinctly that somewhere in the early days, I had been appointed chairman of a curriculum committee to have a look at our curriculum. And this committee had come up with rather radical suggestions concerning a revision of the curriculum. And I made the report to the faculty in one of the lecture rooms. And as soon as I sat down, Dr. Carpenter thanked me for the report and said he was disbanding the curriculum committee as of that minute. And that was the last we ever heard of anything like that.
What sort of revolutionary curriculum were you in?
Well, we had students taking every course about twice. They would take basic sciences before they went into clinical medicine and then take it after they'd been into clinical medicine.
A real planned review.
Right.
Do you feel that as members of the faculty you had comfortable access to Coy Carpenter? Or?
Yes, I think we did. Dr. Carpenter was an open man. This was one of his hallmarks, I think, that he was able to get along with all sorts of people, from lowly instructors to presidents of banks, and he could talk with you on the particular footing that you found yourself in at that time. And I think that this was very much in his favor and in his stead in getting this school started. He also was a very daring man, or he never would have undertaken to start a medical school on the amount of money that was available to him at that time. I think the sum of money was around $600,000, which he did not touch as capital. The decision was made to borrow money against that sum to build the old original building of the medical school, which was attached to the North Carolina Baptist Hospital. Dr. Carpenter, there were many spots in which he was, I might say, ignorant about medicine, a medical school at that time, but he learned very quickly. I remember one incident that illustrates this. He was recruiting Tinsley Harrison to come in as the first professor of medicine, and he came away from a meeting with Tinsley completely shaken and aghast, because Tinsley had asked him where the laboratories from medicine were going to be located in medical school. And his reply was, well, you're in medicine. You don't need any animal laboratories. You see patients, and that's all you need. But he was convinced that animal laboratories were necessary, and pharmacologists suffered by this because he took over an area which had been set aside for a pharmacology student laboratory, and turning this into, by putting up petitions, into laboratories for the Department of Medicine. But he never considered the possibility that a clinician would do laboratory investigation.
Well, if you look at the laboratories and the clinical sizes now, it looks as if Tinsley was right. There certainly is a great deal of animal work going on in all of the clinical departments, as well as the basic science. Could you tell us something about the way pharmacology developed, say, as a first block between the time you came in 1941 and the time you became department chairman, I believe, around 1963?
As I've mentioned, at the two-year school at Wake Forest College, it was a combined department of physiology and pharmacology, and the plan was to continue as a combined department after it moved to this institution. I was appointed as assistant professor of physiology and pharmacology with the responsibility of organizing a teaching and research program in pharmacology, which I did. And I continued alone in this capacity until 1950. Now, at times I would have some help from, instructional help from other members in the department or the clinical staff. One of the first things I did in setting up an instructional program was to arrange for clinics to be held before the second year medical students periodically, about once a week, and these clinics were supervised and held by members of the clinical staff, and many of them did an excellent job in this. Well, this was rather new in medical education at the time. I remember attending a meeting at the University of Minnesota, and we went over one day to Rochester, Minnesota, where the Mayo Clinic is located, for lunch. All of the members attending the meeting went by bus, and at the luncheon, those sitting around me began to question me about this matter of clinics. They had heard that this was being done at Bowman Gray, and they wanted to know how we did it and what some of our results were. And I think this was a beginning of a clinical integration into the basic sciences, and continues to this day. Now, Dr. Ed Truett, E.B. Truett, Jr., came to us in 1950 from the University of Maryland, where he had just received his doctorate in pharmacology. And so he joined us to help in the instruction and in the research program of pharmacology at that time. Dr. Truett left the department in the summer of 1955 to return to Maryland as associate professor of pharmacology at the university there. We immediately began to seek a replacement for him, and in 1956 we were able to employ Dr. Eugene Conrad, who had just a few years before that received his degree from Vanderbilt University. Now, Dr. Conrad remained here until 1959, when he left for employment at Sterling Winthrop Laboratories. Now, from 1959 until 1961, I remained as the sole person in pharmacology. And in 1961, three persons joined the pharmacology portion of the staff of physiology and pharmacology. One of these was Dr. Charles Henley, who came to us from the research laboratories of Schering Corporation and was primarily interested in neuropharmacology. Dr. Ivan Davidson, who is still in the department, in the section on pharmacology, came from the research laboratories of Union Carbide Chemical Company. And Dr. Davidson had a primary interest in endocrinology and biochemical pharmacology. And also Dr. Leonard Graham joined the department, coming from the Department of Biochemistry of the University of Illinois. And Dr. Graham was trained primarily in the study of biologically active polypeptides. In 1963, the department was established, being separated from the Department of Physiology, and we had originally that same faculty that I have just mentioned was the original faculty of the Department of Pharmacology. We did receive help from the faculty of the Physiology, and Dr. Green and Carlos Rapella helped us, and then we had some other associates from other departments, particularly Dr. Norman Leek, who was at that time a chemist, having come here from Massengill Pharmaceutical Corporation, and was working in the OBGYN Research Laboratory with Dr. Burt. And Dr. J.R.R. Bob, Dr. Leroy Crandall, who was professor of anesthesiology, Dr. Thomas Simpson, who at that time was working in the area of parasitology, and Dr. Vernon Bond, who is now a practicing physician in Winston-Salem and was part-time in the Department of Physiology. Prior to its establishment as a department, there was a section on physiology and a section on pharmacology established within the Department of Physiology and Pharmacology. And I believe this was established about 1961 as a separate section in the Department of Physiology at the time these three men joined us, and remained as a separate section within the Department of Physiology and Pharmacology until 1963. Now, the department developed during the period 1963 to 1973, and then in 1973, the department was dissolved as such and recombined with the Department of Physiology as a section on pharmacology.
I can well remember some of those clinics that you instituted, and that I believe we adopted your leadership there on that, and had them in both the physiology courses and the pharmacology courses.
Yes, that's true.
And we're very grateful for the idea of being introduced. One that I can remember, one of the instructors in particularly from the clinical branches that I remember quite vividly was George Harrell, who really used to hold the students' attention tremendously with his handling of these clinical things, and he, clinic basic science correlations, and he seemed to have an unusually good grasp of some of the basic concepts, whereas some of the others were just a clinical lecture.
George was very successful in this. Also, instead of having a resident give the history, as was the case in many such clinics, the resident intern would give the history of the patient, and there was usually a patient present at these clinics. George would not do that. He would come in and elicit the history from the patient in front of the students and with the students. I remember he would walk around through the classroom, and he would ask the patient a question or two, and then he'd turn to a student and say, "Now, what else do we need to know, do you think, about this situation?" And the student would make a suggestion. He would criticize his suggestion or use it. And in essence, then, he was teaching medicine, particularly in the area of history taking. And the students didn't realize this, but they were being indoctrinated into the correct method of taking a history at that time. But he never let this overwhelm the pharmacologic aspect of the clinic. I think he was a past master at that sort of thing.
Are there any of the other clinical people that you recall anything particular about in this association between the clinical and the pharmacological and the physiological?
Not particularly. His performance was so outstanding that it stayed with me throughout all these years. But I'm sure there were others who did an equally good job.
Somehow or other, that's the same impression that I had. Mm-hmm. George is a very enthusiastic man, and I thought a very brilliant man.
He was very much interested in the problems of medical education. That was one of his prime interests, I think, throughout his whole life, as witnessed by the fact that he, when he left here, established two medical schools, one at the University of Florida at Gainesville, and then from there to Hershey, Pennsylvania, where he established the medical school of Penn State, being dean at both of those institutions, since retired just a year or so ago.
Coming back to the various ways in which pharmacology and physiology have been grouped in the institution, could you make any comments, or would you care to, on what freedom you or lack of freedom you may have had in recruiting people for the pharmacology while it was a combined department, and then as it became a separate department, and perhaps as it may or may not be in the present arrangement.